Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is A Gist of Freedom. You are listening to Leslie Gist. We are experiencing technical difficulties. We have on the line attorney, Mr. Michael Cord. Let's see if he's here.
Yes, I am here. Attorney Michael Cord is here.
Great. Michael, we're trying to get a hold of Dr. Leonard Jeffries. Could you just introduce yourself to the audience while I get him on the line? And I'd like for you to talk about the Philadelphia Museum as well.
Not a problem. I'd be happy to do that until Dr. Leonard Jeffries gets on, but I'm ready to start at this point.
Great, great. Go forward.
All right. For those who are listening, my name is Michael Cord. I'm actually an attorney and an activist from Philadelphia. And I'm honored tonight to be co-hosting with the great Dr. Leonard Jeffries. We understand that there might be some minor technical glitches, and we're trying to get Dr. Jeffries on in just a few seconds. Again, my name is Michael Cord. I'm an attorney and activist from Philadelphia, and I'm not even close to being the type of great historian that Dr. Leonard Jeffries is, but in my work as a community activist, I've been involved in a lot of projects that require you to become an expert in history as quickly as possible. And as a black man in America who's going through the educational system, I understand how important it is not only to learn your history, but to share your history. Let me just give you some background information about myself. And just briefly, even before that, Dr. Leonard Jeffries will be on to talk about what he's doing and what he's done. But let me just tell you why I refer to him as the great Dr. Leonard Jeffries. I mean, here's a man who graduated way back in the day from Lafayette College, predominantly white institution. He graduated with honors from Lafayette. He then went on to Columbia, where he got his master's degree, and not long after, he received a Ph.D., and that's why we call him Dr. Leonard Jeffries. He's also the founding chairman of the Black Studies Department at San Jose State College. So based on that little bit I shared with you, you can understand why it's so important that you stay tuned to hear from this man. But he's not just a scholar or an intellectual or a professor or a historian. He's certainly all of that. But in addition to that, he's also a frontline activist. Far too often, we know that there are Afrocentric scholars out there, but they stay in their lofty towers, in their ivy towers, in these major universities, and they write a lot of good stuff, but they don't really do anything. Well, Dr. Leonard Jeffries is a much different type of individual. Yes, he has his undergraduate degree, his master's degree, his Ph.D. He's the founding chairman of the Black Studies Department at San Jose State College, but he doesn't stop there. He's always on the front line as an activist, bringing that intellectualism to the people. That's what separates him from other great scholars who are great scholars, but they do nothing else, and other great activists who are great activists, but they do nothing else. We get the best of both worlds from Dr. Leonard Jeffries. And by the way, when he does come on, he's going to talk to us about what has happened, good and bad, during his tenure at City College of New York. A lot of folks began to know of him and hear of him from City College of New York, where he was a tenured professor and the chairman of the African American Studies Department. But there were some other things that went on at City College of New York, and he will be happy to share all of that, the good and the bad. But before we get to him, again, as I pointed out earlier, my name is Michael Cord. I'm an activist and an attorney, and I do often, when I refer to myself in connection with being a lawyer, I always say, hey, I am not a lawyer who happens to be a black man. Instead, I'm a black man who just happens to be a lawyer, and there's a major difference. I'm sure that Dr. Jeffries would say that something along those lines, that he's not a professor who happens to be a black man, that he's a black man first who just happens to be a professor. In terms of my activism, I guess I can start by pointing out I host a radio show in Philadelphia called the Radio Courtroom, and that's at WURD 900 AM. If you want to get to it, you can get to it by phone or you can get to it on the internet at www.900amwurd.com. And I host that show on that station called the Radio Courtroom. And even before I go further to tell you about myself, I want to give credit where credit is due. Big shout out to Leslie Gist of On the Gist of Freedom show here on Blog Talk Radio. If it weren't for Leslie Gist, you wouldn't be hearing from me, you wouldn't be hearing from Dr. Leonard Jeffries, you wouldn't hear from the other activists and scholars and VIPs and other folks she has on her show. So big shout out to Leslie. Getting back to who I am, as I said, I host a radio show called The Radio Courtroom. It's an Afrocentric legal advice talk show, but not just legal advice. We also talk history and politics and culture and current events. Apart from me hosting that radio show, I'm the one of the founding members of a group called ATAC, A-T-A-C. That stands for Avenging the Ancestors Coalition. And one of the things that I'm going to talk to Dr. Leonard Jeffries about is what he has done in New York to bring the history to the people. And that's the kind of thing that I try to do to make the history relevant to the people by bringing it to the people. And I say that in order to tell you this part. We in Philadelphia made history. By we, I mean Avenging the Ancestors Coalition. It's a group of scholars and activists and ministers and elected officials and folks from the community and teachers and lawyers and all types of folks who came together, descendants of enslaved Africans from America and descendants of great Africans from the motherland, the continent of Africa. And these black folks came together way back in 2002 because we found out there was a local newspaper story back in 2002 indicating that the Liberty Bell Center here in Philadelphia, that the Liberty Bell Center was going to move from its then location near 5th and Market, about a half block west to 6th and Market. This is the news we heard back in 2002. And all of us in the black community, we said, well, interesting, but not really relevant to us as black folks in America. The second thing that we found out about in connection with this 2002 news report is that the new site of the Liberty Bell, 6th and Market, would be where America's first White House stood. Now, many people think that the first White House was in D.C. It was not. They think it was in New York. It was not. Essentially, basically, it was right here in Philadelphia. Back then, in 1790, it was not called the White House, but it served, in effect, as America's first White House. Back in 1790, it was referred to as the President's House or the Executive Mansion, or by some, the Robert Morris Mansion, but it served in effect, and historians will tell you this, served in effect as America's first White House. So follow me on this. First, we find out the Liberty Bell Center is moving. Second, we find out it's moving to the site of America's first White House. And once again, we in the black community say we're, you know, we that probably is interesting, but it's not really relevant to us as black folks in America. Then we found out a third thing in that newspaper article from 2002. That third thing is that in addition to the Liberty Bell moving to 6th and Market, in addition to that being the site of America's first White House, it was also the site where George Washington, the father of this country, the first president of the United States, held black men, women, and children in brutal bondage as so-called slaves, right here in Philadelphia, right at America's first White House, the cradle of liberty here in Philadelphia. And it's not just a matter of George Washington holding those nine. We also found out that he enslaved a total of 316 black men, black women, and black children at his Mount Vernon, Virginia plantation and brought nine of them amongst those 316, brought nine of them to Philadelphia. And when folks found out that this was the site of America's first White House, for the most part, the people at the historical park area, the National Park Service, Independence National Historical Park, the way it works is there's federal agencies that have jurisdiction on the local level. It's Independence National Historical Park. On the regional level, it's called the National Park Service. So once they got all this information about George Washington, the first White House, their plans were to celebrate American history by celebrating George Washington, by celebrating the first White House. And they began to come up with some ideas and plans to commemorate that site as what they called the President's House. And they had no concern whatsoever about any black people. In fact, they wouldn't even talk about black people. We later found out that the National Park Service and the Independence National Historical Park folks, they knew that George Washington had enslaved black folks right here in Philadelphia at America's First White House. They knew about that since the early 1970s, 1973, 1974. But they chose, well, I'm not just going to say not talk about it. They actually chose to hide it because that's certainly important information. America's First White House, George Washington enslaving people. You know about this since 1973, 74, and here it is, early 2000. You're not talking about it? Well, that's exactly what happened. And the reason why they wouldn't talk about slavery at that site is because, remember, they found out this is the site of America's First White House. It's also the site where they have the Liberty Bell, and you know, the Liberty Bell is the national symbol of freedom. And there's no way, as far as they were concerned, that you could talk about slavery at the White House. No way you could talk about slavery near the Liberty Bell. So clearly, well, obviously Liberty Bell came later, but slavery at the site where the Liberty Bell eventually was located. And,
okay.
Yes.
Hello, can you hear me, Attorney Court?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Dr. Jeffries.
Okay, we have Dr. Jeffries on the line. I apologize. Thank you so much, Dr. Jeffries, for being on.
No problem.
And thank you for holding it down for us. I'm going to let you gentlemen start. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Dr. Jeffries, I very rarely am lost for words, but I have to admit right now I'm kind of lost for words that I met you for the first time back in 1996. At the, I believe it was the ASCAC convention in Africa. And I had heard so much, I had heard so much about this great Dr. Leonard Jeffries, and he was going to be a part of some panel discussions at this ASCAC convention in West Africa in 1996. So I got in the plane and got there, and everything I heard about you was so true. I mean, not only intelligent, but charismatic. And before you got on tonight, Dr. Jeffries, I gave a brief intro. Let me just spend about 1 minute repeating that for those who just tuned in.
Okay.
I'm going to turn it over to you. I had pointed out that I refer to you as the great Dr. Leonard Jeffries because I know your background. I know that you went to Lafayette College, predominantly white, where you graduated with honors, that you got your master's degree from Columbia. And we're not talking about 5, 10 years ago. We're talking about, what, 30, 40 years ago? Here you are getting these bachelor's degrees and these master's degrees, and later, in 1971, PhD, when that was unheard of. Blacks just weren't getting that kind of thing. Then I found out that this gentleman, Dr. Jeffries, is the founding chairman of the Black Studies Department at San Jose State College. And I found out about your involvement at the City College of New York, where you were a tenured professor and the chair of the African-American Studies Department. And then I began to, and this is where I'm going to turn it over to you, Dr. Jeffries, and I hear something about some battles you had with the folks at City College of New York for stuff they said was controversial. But before we get into that, please share with the listening audience a little bit more than what I talked about in terms of your background, because before folks can appreciate what you say, they need to know who you are. So if you could talk for a few minutes, Dr. Jeffries, about your background, filling in some of the gaps I might have missed.
Well, certainly I appreciate the chance to be a part of the radio program and talk to your radio family. And it's always a pleasure for me to communicate with my people. Because my, you know, my personal mission is to try to lift us up globally, and so I not only find that New York, New Jersey, is my area of work, but the United States, the Western Hemisphere, including all of Brazil and the islands of the Caribbean and Europe. As well as the African continent. I'll be leaving for Africa in 2 weeks for a conference, the World Summit of Black Mayors. And the head of the World Summit of Black Mayors is Mayor, our brother in East Orange, Lee Bowser. And and our family, he's been, and his family, the Jeffries, have known each other for more than half a century. So it's great to be a part of what I call the Great Awakening of African peoples.
Yes.
And that's what this last, since 1945, has been what I call the Great Awakening, where people have moved together and tried to lift themselves up. But I'm most proud that I was born and raised in Newark, New Jersey. And people say, well, you were born and raised in Newark? Certainly was. That's where I got my foundation. Very proud of it. That's where I got my formation.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very substantial. And it's lasted me. And the beautiful thing was that I was born January 19, 1937 in Newark. And my family, my mother, father, my brother and I lived on 14th Street in Newark. My mother's family lived on 13th Street in Newark. My father's family lived on 12th Street. So
mm-hmm.
the Roseville area of Newark, near East Orange and Orange Street and Central Avenue, that was a village. And Newark was divided up into many villages, and it was in that setting that I got my foundation. Of the 100 kids, youngsters, young people, males and females that I grew up with, 90 of us made it, and many of us made it big. You hear what I said? Of the 100 youngsters I grew up with, 90 of us made it, and many of us made it big. And very few of us was lost to
Let me ask you this, Dr. Jeffries. How do you explain that you're talking about the 1930s and 40s in Newark, and obviously none of you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth?
No, these were hard, working-class black folk, but they came together from different parts of the South. And at that point, we didn't have much of a migration in from the West Indies, but they came from the different parts of Georgia, North Carolina, Virginia, and they worked together as a community. They saw all of us as potential. They saw all of us as the possibility. They saw all of us as worthy of their love and affection. And so it wasn't just Dr. Jeffries and his brother Marlon at 80 South 14th Street. Across the street from us were the Spellmans. And that included a Robert Spellman, who became Dr. Robert Spellman. A professor at Essex County College, and his brother James, and his sisters, etc. Next to them were the Fosters. Albert Foster worked 35 years for the city of Newark. Samuel Foster, who became the principal of Quitman Street School when it was the largest new school in New Jersey, and their sister Gloria. And next to them were the Olivers, Percy Oliver, who was graduated from Westside High School, went on to be a great basketball star, became a teacher. His sister Nancy was a teacher. Percy just came in from Brazil. Down the street were others who were had done substantial work. Right next to me, across from me on the same side, was my family, the Catinos, and my cousin, the beautiful Dolores Catino. She became the head of Planned Parenthood in New Jersey.
Okay.
My brother Sonny and I were born at the same week, so we were raised like we were brothers. And then you had a fantastic brother who passed a few years ago, Presley Woods. And Presley, when he lost his mother and father, him and his sister were raised by members of our family and our community. He went on to be the eighth grade teacher at at Sussex Avenue School. You know, eighth grade teacher is the teacher that prepares you for graduation. That's a prestigious position.
Okay.
I'm talking this, and that's just 14th Street. I'm talking about 13th Street. My cousin, John Benson, went on to become a chemist, graduating from Bloomfield College, set up his own business. And the Young brothers and the Presley Woods and his family. The whole community. And all the community helped us. You know, they have this saying that it takes a whole village to raise a child.
Definitely.
I just thought about that today. My wife and I went out to Whole Foods, and we got some decent food. And I was listening to this radio broadcast on WVAI, and this sister was running down the struggle of black folk since slavery, during slavery, and since slavery to educate their people. And then I realized that saying it takes a whole village is too general. It needs to be more specific. It takes an extended African family and a whole village to raise a black child. And see, for me, what I'm talking about is the extended African family. My mother and father was the nuclear family on 14th Street, but her older sister, was my second mother. She was on 13th Street, along with other members of the family. On 14th Street was my father's sister, who raised Tim and Bessie. They were business people. They had a cleaners and whatnot, own property. So that you're talking about an extended African family being the key component of the concept of extended families coming together to form the village. And that's what we had. We had an African village. You had to be correct. If you weren't correct, anybody in the village could take you off to the side, whack your butt, then take you home, and then your mother would get you, and
okay.
then you'd have to wait for your father to come home from work to take care of business. I mean, we had accountability. You couldn't imagine no youngsters walking around the African village in Newark, New Jersey, with their drawers hanging off their behind. We were trained to keep our drawers over our behind and show the world our mind.
Yes.
So there's no way that you can have the type of individuality and the type of lack of respect that we now have. Our people got caught up into trying to make a whole lot of money and trying to keep up with the Joneses, and they forgot to keep their hands on their children. So the education we got was in our homes first before we walked it into the school. My mother gave me my first book, and it wasn't Dick, Jane, and Spot, Little Red Riding Hood and the Seven Drawers, Jack and the Beanstalk. It was Booker T. Washington, Up from Slavery. It
mm-hmm.
was a brown, dark-covered, hard-covered book that I couldn't read, but I could see the pictures of outstanding black people, et cetera, et cetera. The first book to begin to let me appreciate learning was Booker T. Washington, Up from Slavery. And then my mother, inspired by her father, was my first teacher, my master teacher. You know, she taught us. She graduated from Central High School. My father graduated from Westside High School during the Depression. And that was an achievement for black folks then, because most of the children would have to be out there trying to scuffle and work and bring in something for the family. But our families were substantial enough to allow my mother and father to graduate from high school from Newark, New Jersey. So they both appreciated learning.
Absolutely.
And both appreciated forming your young people into something. And my somehow or other, my mother got in her mind that I needed to learn how to be a saxophone player. So for 10 to 15 years, I played the sax. My father was a semi-pro Negro League baseball player. So somehow or other, I got in my head I wanted to be a baseball player. And then all of a sudden, here comes Jackie Robinson, 1946. He played in Montreal, 1947. He played on the Brooklyn Dodgers. So a lot of us black youngsters wanted to be somebody like a Jackie Robinson. Break down the barriers. Open up the door and let your people come through. And before Jackie Robinson, 46, you had Joe Louis. I remember with my little white kids going to grammar school, and Joe Louis beat up Billy Kahn. Black kids was pounding their hearts and their chests because this brown bomber had put himself on the world stage. And even though my little Irish friends was hoping for Billy Kahn to win, Joe Louis took him down, and we was taken up. So this is the type of growing up that we had. We didn't have the people worrying about no drugs. There's a few people was sipping off some Gypsy Rose with some wine. But, we didn't have – the family would have taken care of those problems. A drug dealer couldn't live on in our community like they invaded our community later because they were our own people. And we had to tolerate them because they were our own sons, our own nephews. And that drug dumping in our community was part of the conspiracy to weaken black folk from the larger system that couldn't handle black people coming out of depression, going into World War II, and then coming out of World War II, putting it together for their people. They're beginning to move in the south of the United States, move in the north of the United States, and then making demands on the society, and then beginning to take control of their destiny in ways that white folks had never envisioned. So, I mean, that's my foundation. I might have done good things with it, and I certainly have, but I attribute it to what happened to me in Newark, New Jersey, with the whole family.
Those of you who have just tuned in, you heard the voice of Dr. Leonard Jeffries. The voice you hear right now is Attorney Michael Cord. I'm from Philadelphia. I'm an activist and an attorney, and I'm honored to be co-hosting this show. By the way, I got to give a big shout out to Leslie Gist of on the Gist of Freedom. She's responsible for this Blog Talk radio show, and she's invited me, Attorney Michael Cord, along with the great Dr. Leonard Jeffries, to talk about historical issues. And those of you who tuned in just now, and unfortunately, you missed some great information. Those of you who've been with us since 8 o'clock, you heard us talk about Dr. Leonard Jeffries graduating from Lafayette College a very long time ago, predominantly white school, but graduating with honors, and then going on to Columbia and getting his master's, then going on to get his PhD in 1971, becoming the founding chairman of the Black Studies Department at San Jose State College, but didn't stop there. He then went on to become a tenured professor at City College of New York and the chair, I repeat, the chair of the African American Studies Department. And he's not a braggart, so he didn't talk about this stuff and these accomplishments like I did, but he went in to explain how he and many others from his Newark community got to this point, how despite the fact that they didn't grow up with, they still were spooning them out, that the community came together, the family came together to get them where they are. And the thing I want to ask Dr. Leonard Jeffries before we get into some specifics about what happened at the City College of New York with the alleged controversy, the thing I want to ask Dr. Leonard Jeffries is, how do you explain, though, of those 190 going on to do well, when you look at other communities in Philadelphia, in Chicago, in Detroit, in wherever, why couldn't they do what you and your family and you and your community did in Newark at that time or even later? How do you explain your situation and your community, your family being so unique?
Well, it was unique for us young people. But it wasn't so unique. See, we don't understand or know the family history of African peoples. We don't understand or appreciate that we came out of a process of enslavement which was designed to tear us down as human beings and never let us rise, and to keep us under the foot of the largest white society. We came up out of the South under those circumstances and began to build. And so Newark was a community of villages.
Yes.
At 10 years old, my mother and father, someone purchased our house. The Clark family purchased our house. So we had a dilemma. So what do we do at 10? So my mother and father worked out a situation where my father and her went to live with his auntie, Aunt Bessie, who raised him. And they were on 12th Street. She had several homes, so they had no problem making a way for my father, who was raised like her son. And so the two of us, my brother and I, we weren't just thrown anywhere. We were sent down neck in Newark, New Jersey. That's the Ironbound section. We were out in the west end of Newark. That's the where we were raised, Roseville. But my aunt and her and three branches of our family left 13th Street and went to live, the first black people to integrate the housing projects called Riverview Court down on Chapel Street in Newark, New Jersey. In 1946-47, they went down there. The white folks lived in the center of the housing project, and the buildings around the periphery were integrated with black folks. Our family was the first to go down there, to three branches of our family, including John Benson, the one who became the chemist, including Geraldine, Jerry Lockery. She became a teacher, including my cousin who helped to really raise us, Dorothy, who became a business person, her husband setting up a floor waxing business. So from the housing project now, we were glad to go. My brother and I, we said, wow, this ain't to break up the family. We're joining the part of the family that left us and then going down. And then we lived up on the second floor. And the biggest challenge for us was 1947. They had the blizzard of 47. And the wind and the storms were such that blew that snow right up to the second floor of my aunt's apartment house. We got some cardboard boxes, and we started building a slide down from the second floor and taking advantage of the blizzard. But here's the thing. From all the way across Newark, where the 34 bus picks you up, 34 Market, and takes us all the way across to Roseville Avenue, and we got off. My cousin, for 2 years we did that. And so even though we lived all the way across the town, my cousin Darcy, who went on to girls' vocational school, she dropped us off at Sussex Avenue, and then we went on to our school. But in that time, I looked at my report card. My mother saved all the report cards. I never missed a day, was never late. And how could that be? And during that time, I wasn't in disarray. I didn't fall by the wayside, wasn't discontent. 1947, Jackie comes into the world. 1948, he's doing it. 1949, he's king of the world. He becomes the most valuable player. And us black kids, so inspired by Jackie, I became the best player, the best saxophone player, the best baseball player. I became the president of Sussex Avenue Grammar School and graduated, me and the few black kids and the dozens of white kids, and I was their leader. So even though I was separated from my root family, my mother and father, but I was with my extended family, I still had the love, I still had the direction, I still had the protection, I still had the motivation, I still had the mission. And it wasn't just us. Even in that Riverview project, we just put to rest my best living buddy from my old neighborhood, who I met in the housing project 65 years ago, and his name was Kenneth Travitt. His father had died when he was five. His mother and them were on welfare. But from that welfare family that I met in the projects, he became a great teacher, eventually administrator in North Schools, married a woman, Olivia Travitt. They married 2 weeks after my wife and I married. And in December of 64, Olivia became a great teacher. Their daughter, Kenya, is a teacher with Ross Baraka at Central High School in Newark now. Their son, my godson, just as Kenya is my goddaughter, is living with my brother in Brooklyn, and he's doing great things. All these youngsters have gone to Egypt with us and gone to Africa with us. And so I'm saying that in spite of the fact that I'm talking about the uniqueness of what I experienced, that was a continuation in the village down neck in the housing project. So I'm saying in many of these areas, we did come together and we forged young people to be strong. So Philadelphia has its examples. Atlanta has its examples. St. Louis. Akron, Ohio. Our people came up, my father's side, from Georgia and went into Akron. There's 1,000 of us in Akron. Doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, owning property, building housing projects. And so they came up out of Georgia and they took that rural community spirit of communal cooperative and collective of working together, and they planted it in these urban areas. We were reasonably well in different parts of black America in the 50s and 60s, and that's why you had the explosion of the cities and black people demanding more things. But then the reaction in the 70s said, let's dump on the black communities. Let's try to destroy them. Then drugs were purposely put in our communities. The attack on our young people became targeted by this larger society. And so, but there are examples throughout my life and looking at black America of other communities, not just my little unique community. Wasn't unique. Councilman Donald Tucker, who was one of the great leaders of Newark, he came from the projects down neck in Newark and was very proud of that and maintained an allegiance with the various people who came from. Donald Bradley, M.D., Donald Bradley. I remember Donald Bradley. We called him Sleepy. He was an all-state basketball player at Westside High School. And so he becomes a medical doctor, and then he becomes a leader of the Newark City Council. Tucker becomes a leader of New Jersey, coming from where? The projects. So I'm saying we need to look at that history. Robert Spellman lived across the street from me. I went to Africa in 1961 on a program called Crossroads Africa. Robert Spellman, who lived across the street from me, went to that same on that same program in 64. He went to Tanzania. Ken Travitt, who I just mentioned, who was in the housing projects down neck in Newark, he went to Ghana in 64. Three boys who happened to be a part of my family went to Africa in the 60s. And we continued to work it, linking black people together. My brother went with me, wanted to, he was trying to go in 65, 66. He didn't make it, but he went in 69, and he went many times after. His sons went as part of their rites of passage in the 80s. And then those same sons are doing it in Brooklyn. Hakeem graduated at the top of NYU Law School, and he's now a state assemblyman in New York. He had gone to Binghamton, upstate New York. I try to get the kids to go down south to the schools, and of the 20 or so God kids I have, most of them went down south. Brother Small's kids, Professor Scobie's kids, my brother's youngest went to Morehouse. And with that Jeffrey's motivation, that Jeffrey's plan, that you put strength in your children and that you support them and that the community is called upon to work with them, the younger one, he didn't get wayward and jealous of his older brother. He followed the plan. The plan is you're going to be a success. And so he went to Morehouse, graduated at the top of Morehouse, was almost the valedictorian like his son, like his older brother was. He missed being the valedictorian in Morehouse because of one grade. He had a B in the religious class. He had one B in 4 years of all A's.
Wow.
And he still graduated at the top. He was number two. But that didn't stop him. He eventually went on to Duke after he graduated Morehouse. And then he did a study of the struggle of the voting rights in Lowndes County, in which the Black Panther symbol was raised, and the struggle around Selma. And he went on to Ohio State. He's a tenured professor at Ohio State. And then when he completed his book, which was published by NYU Press, he dedicated to Uncle Lenny for everything.
Those of you who
have,
let me just say this, Dr. Jeffries, because I know folks are tuning in each and every minute, and they hear these powerful words of wisdom from this man whose voice they might not recognize. It's certainly the voice of Dr. Leonard Jeffries, a big-time activist, big-time scholar, but first and foremost a Black man, first and foremost an African. And he's explained to us that his situation, the situation of his family, his community 30, 40, 50 years ago is not really unique. It happened in his community, happened in many other communities. So maybe instead of us today as Black folks looking at the situation where the glass is half empty, maybe it's actually half full and even more so. But let me do this.
You better believe it. There was somebody in Philadelphia called the Reverend Leon Sullivan.
Yes.
And Leon Sullivan in Philadelphia on Broad Street decided that he was going to put an institution, an organization together, use his progress, his church, as the basis for constructing Progress Plaza and the organization called OIC, which was going to train our youth. And so that community in Philadelphia was an inspiration to Ken Travitt and myself and others in Newark in the 60s, because after we had the urban rebellion in Newark in 67 and Newark was in flames and a lot of the community was destroyed, our thing wasn't burn, baby, burn. It may have been before, but once these explosions took place, our thing was build, baby, build. So we went to Philadelphia to look for a model of the community building for itself. And that Progress Plaza became a model for us, so we developed the Greater Newark Development Corporation and the Greater Newark Foods Corporation to create a shopping center with the food food shopping as the centerpiece, and the Greater Newark Development Corporation would be getting involved in housing. I'm saying, you're talking about the 60s, young Black folk coming just out of college or still in college, working with older Black folk, talking about building in their community, and having Philadelphia's Broad Street Progress community in that church that he used as a model inspiring us.
Again, those who tune in, you keep hearing these powerful words, enlightening words from Dr. Leonard Jeffries, and not just talking about what happened in Newark, but also relating it to Philly. One of the things I want to do, Dr. Jeffries, is I know as a historian of American history and African-American history and African history and even world history, you have a lot to say about, for example, some American figures, historical figures. Talk for a minute, if you will, a few minutes, if you will, Dr. Jeffries, about your views on Thomas Edison and Louis Latimer, and also your views on Granville T. Woods and Alexander Graham Bell, because you're a scholar, you're a historian, and you know that throughout the school systems in America, they talk about Thomas Edison, but not too much about Louis Latimer. They talk about Alexander Graham Bell, but not too much about Granville T. Woods. So we don't hear about the type of people who come from your community and from your family and my community. Talk for a minute, if you will, about Granville T. Woods, Alexander Graham Bell, Thomas Edison, and Louis Latimer.
Well, I'll definitely talk about those brothers because they're all an inspiration, and it's the same phenomena. It's not them as individuals, it's them as the extended African family. And so they're perfect examples of that. But before that, I want to talk about my pablum, my baby food when I grew up, and my brother's baby food, and much of the baby food of the people I grew up with. That pablum, as I said, was not Dick Cheney's, but it included understanding our history, like Booker T. Washington. What did he do?
Yeah.
He was an institution builder. What did he do? He came up out of slavery. He threw that aside and began to build for his people. He said, put your buckets down where you are and learn how to build your own homes, raise your own food, invent your own inventions. So
Amen.
Booker T. was part
Amen.
Of the pablum. And then Booker T. had a counterpart who grew up later. He didn't come out of slavery. He came out of the free community of the North, and that was W.E.B. Du Bois. He was born in 1868, the same time my father's father was born. In Georgia, he was born in Massachusetts. Well, W.E.B. Du Bois became part of the pablum of my early childhood because somehow or other he was doing a study of the migration of black people out of the South, Virginia in particular, into a city called Philadelphia.
Okay.
And eventually he wrote in 1903 The Philadelphia Negro. But before he did that, he studied the migration patterns, and one of the bases he used was Farmville, Virginia, which is where my mother's people are from. So while he was studying the families in Farmville, Virginia, and their migration patterns and their skill development into Philadelphia and the adjustment from a small rural town into a larger developing city, while he did that, he met my mother's aunt, great aunt Pocahontas, because we came out of the Powhatan Indian. And Pocahontas became one of the secretaries of W.E.B. Du Bois. So W.E.B. Du Bois, along with Booker T., was part of my pablum. And then my grandfather, whose birthday I was born on, January the 19th, he was born 1888, I was born 1937, my grandfather was a Garveyite. He was a Booker T. Washingtonite, W.E.B. Du Boisite, and a Garveyite. So that was my pablum, Booker T., W.E.B., and Marcus Garvey. And so this whole question of the Civil War and the struggle around the Civil War, I knew black troops fought in the Civil War because I had the books. I brought that to McKinley High School in Newark, New Jersey, and the teacher told me, you got to be crazy. Black people didn't fight in the Civil War. I said, wait a minute. This was in the 1950s, 51 or so, and the woman was saying, when I brought her the books, this was communist propaganda. Now, the person I was citing in his great works was W.E.B. Du Bois. So this was a real challenge because this was the McCarthy period when they were trying to make black people who were struggling out to be communists. But
Very
I stood
true.
My ground. I said, here are the troops, here are the pictures, here are the thousands of black folks that fought. So I had to challenge the teacher early on. In that struggle in the Civil War was a black man called Latimer. He had fought out of slavery in the 1850s, made his way to freedom in New England, and then when the Civil War came, Lattimore's sons were willing to go back down south, joining the Union Army to fight for freedom. So Louis Latimer was the youngest one. He tried to get into the Union Army, the Massachusetts 54th, but he could not because of his age. So his older brothers got into the Union Army, and they were in the Massachusetts 54th that marched on Fort Wagner as an example of the ability of black men to take up arms and defend themselves. Lewis, before he became the famous inventor, at 15 he falsified his age and went into the Union Army. So the three Latimer brothers, whose father fought out of slavery, were fighting to free other black people in the Civil War. Then after the Civil War was over, he became a giant in terms of working with the great white American giants. He worked as a partner of Edison, and in fact, Edison had a group of Edison pioneers and whatnot. He was one of the Edison pioneers, but he also worked with Maxim, and he also worked with one of the other greats. They were trying to get him. He was so good. There was a vying of bringing this brother on their team. But Edison prevailed. He designed the carbon filament that goes into the light bulb that made Edison's light bulb a real invention, because before it would go out. You can't have a light that goes out, but once Louis Latimer developed the carbon filament, it made Edison's light bulb work. He designed the plans for the lighting of New York, the lighting of London, the lighting of Montreal. This black man. And he was a part of the Edison team. And we used to drive our bikes up the mountains, South Orange Mountains, and we would go to the Edison laboratories and whatnot. We didn't know that one of those men sitting in the picture around Edison was this black man who was not only an inventor, but he was a poet, he was a writer, et cetera. He came out of a struggle. His foundation was going back into slavery and helping black folks defeat slavery. And so the Latimer brothers, that's why I say you mentioned Louis Latimer. I'm saying the Latimer brothers.
Yes.
And the Latimer brothers come out of a father who fought his way out of slavery and then made his way to New England. And then the stray slave catchers try to catch him and take him back into slavery. But he had become such a substantial part of the town in New England that the people raised money for him to remain free. So it wasn't just a Latimer individual. It was a Latimer brothers. It wasn't just a Latimer brothers. It was a Latimer brother and father. And a father can't do everything by himself. So it had to be a Latimer mother and father.
Amen.
Brothers.
Amen.
And so the same thing with Granville Woods. We see Granville T. Woods, but he was just like our brother Latimer. He was desired. Maxim wanted him. Edison wanted him to be a part of his team. But this brother was so independent. He said, I don't want to be a part of any of these new white entrepreneurs. Me and my brother are going to form the Woods Brothers Electrical Company. And so it's Granville T. Woods and his brother.
Yes.
And they were considered the black, he was considered the black Edison.
What's
and
the timeline?
He was so good.
What dates are we talking about? What's the timeline?
We're talking about 1880s. 1870s, 1880s, at a time when white America, black people had come out of slavery, 1865, and they moved so fast because of this desire for education, this desire for training, this desire for skills, this desire for freedom. Between 1865 and 1875, black people coming up out of the slavery that said you weren't even human, they moved so fast on the world stage that it shook white America, North and South. And they decided after the election of 1876, the Hayes-Tilden election, that they're going to put black folk back into semi-slavery. North and South said this freedom movement is just too much. Nowhere in history do you find a 10-year period which an enslaved population moved on the world stage free and then took its destiny in its hand. My grandfather, my father's father, was born in 1868. In 1877, he was barely 10 years old, and the Ku Klux Klan and whatnot had been a part of the rising up of white supremacy to put black folks back. So I said to myself, how did my grandfather, born in 1868, when we were supposed to get the 13th Amendment to free us and end slavery, the 14th Amendment give us a citizen's right, the 15th Amendment in 1870 to give us the right to vote, my grandfather never got those things. White folks never honored that. But still, he came on the world stage crippled with a slavery background, but he stepped full bold to take his manhood. But he didn't do it by himself. He had an older brother, Sam, who was born in 1865 in slavery. And then he had his other sisters and brothers. So how did they, in one generation, come out of the dehumanization of slavery and stand tall? And by the 1880s and 90s, they had marriage, land, they had institutions. The schoolhouse that they built is still standing on our land in Georgia, a three-room schoolhouse. The churches that they built are there. The ruins of the Masonic Order, that he was the head of the Masonic Order. How could he, in one generation, with white folks moving against them, do what he did with all the others that he did it with? We have to look at that story. That's one of the greatest stories not told. We didn't get a helping hand from white folks. Very few white folks wanted to help us. rich white folks got scared because we were moving too fast. Poor
mm-hmm.
white folks were jealous because we were moving too fast, so they formed the Klan to put us back into slavery. My grandfather was born in 1868. He became a leader of his community. He was one of many children. His brother, he had 13 kids. His brother, including my father, who was the last child, his brother Sam had 15. They had their farms together. You can see them on the census maps. These brothers together, the churches that they built are still there in Georgia. He was the head of the Masonic temple that was there, the Daughters of Ruth. Out of this rural clay of Georgia, they built institutions for survival in their community. They took their cotton to the general store, as white folks took their cotton, and they sold their cotton on the cotton train that had come to take that cotton to Savannah and then up to the north for milling. So in one generation, he had moved into greatness. For me, I didn't know that, but it was in his children that helped to raise me, my aunts and uncles. He was killed in 1917, July the 14th, by the new Klan that rose after the Birth of the Nation movie in 1915. And so he was barely 50, but he had achieved. And then my father barely knew him because he was three. My father was born in 1914, so he was 3 years old when his father was killed. But that didn't make any difference. The strength that the father put in his children was passed on to my father through his uncles and his auntie.
Dr.
You have to
Jeffrey,
see generations
Dr.
of the transfer of power and manhood and womanhood as part of our story.
Let me say this, Dr. Jeffries. We're going to have to get with Leslie Gist of the On the Gist of Freedom with this Block Talk radio show and have you on two or three more times because 60 minutes is not enough. We only have about 6 minutes left, and I want you to wrap things up by responding to a couple quick things. What you talked about, what the community has done and what the family has done for the likes of you and your family and friends. You talked about Lewis Latimer. My question to you is, has anything been done lately in terms of black contribution? For example, in Silicon Valley, for those who say that, well, yeah, black folks might have did something in the late 1800s, but what have we done since? What's your response quickly to our contribution to Silicon Valley?
Our contribution to the rising technology of the Western world is very real. There, Silicon Valley was where I developed one of the first black studies programs in the United States.
Wow.
San Jose is the heart of Silicon Valley. 1969, I went to set up the Black Studies Department in San Jose. I was asked to come out. I was teaching at City College, the first black course in the Political Science Department of City College in 1969, and that's when Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, later had passed through, Rap Brown had passed through, King had been assassinated April 68, and they were inspiring black young men and women to take control of their destiny. So the students in my class in February of 1969, they began to demand that the college open up and service black students. They demanded that they put in a remedial courses to help those black students crippled by bad school. They demanded that they put in black seniors and faculty and advisors. They demanded that they have black studies. The demand in City College took place in the spring of 69, and the students took over to back up the demands. In May 69, I was asked to come to a conference in San Jose and then to deal with Malcolm X's legacy. And at that point, they were looking for a leader of their program. James Turner did not go. He went to Cornell. I took the program in San Jose. And so we developed one of the largest programs on the West Coast in San Jose. And in the middle of Silicon Valley, we hooked up with black inventors in Silicon Valley. The curriculum included technological development in the black community. We got blacks from Lockheed and other industrialization enterprises in the Bay Area to teach in our program. So we don't know our history, and the white folks don't want us to know our history. We don't want to know that the cell phone, several of the first patents around the cell phone were by black folks.
Okay.
We don't want to know that other key methodologies, when we think of open heart surgery, first black people that do open heart surgery were our folks. And so our contribution all along the spectrum, literature, philosophy, science and technology, has to be understood to understand how we, against the odds, have established a foundation that our people now don't have a clue about, and they're rapping about this and they're rapping about that. They're raising up 50 Cent instead of looking at Louis Lattimore and Malcolm X, Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, Martin King, and our great sisters who have continued this struggle. And so my role has been to put in place the educational programs, hooking up with people around the world to do the same. And so we're still doing it. We're still doing it with a passion. The young people around us are doing that. Now, that's the story I'll be talking about later, how this has been passed down for generation after generation, and it's not seen because they don't want you to see black folks struggling. But I travel around the world. Just came back from Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago, where the black people in Suriname are doing it in Amsterdam. And before that, I was in Birmingham, not Birmingham, Alabama, Birmingham, England, where the black people in England who brought me year after year back are doing it in Birmingham, England. So, yes, there'll be a continuation. I hope so. I had to give it to the sister for kind of imposed upon me in my busy time. She said, no, Dr. J, we need you.
Let me jump on that, because we are going to try to impose upon you for an extra 15 minutes if we can. We thought we'd have you on from 8 to 9, but due to this demand, we're constantly getting calls and emails and Facebook notices saying, hey, can you keep Dr. Jeffries on until 9:15? So can we impose for an extra 15 minutes?
Well, definitely. Let me just tie this together. Now, I went to Roseville Avenue School, a school built in 1870-something. Then I went on to Sussex School, a school built in 1880-something. These old schools, we learned along with the white kids. And we learned because our parents made us learn in the homes as well as in the churches. Well, every Sunday we would go to church down the street. Oh, Bobby and Ronnie, Sammy Foster. This, these black youngsters would go down to the Sunday school at the end of this, near 14th Street, near 14th Street and Orange Street was our little church, Mount Sinai. But in that church, there were black people putting their hands on us, trying not just teaching some Bible lessons, but teaching us manhood and womanhood, how to respect each other, how to work together, how to read and write, and how to excel. So even the church was not just a place where we went to pray or yell and shout. We went to learn how to be whole, how to help each other. And so I went on to McKinley High School and then on to Barringer High School. But while I got into Barringer High School, there people from the other villages of Newark were, including someone called Leroy Jones, who eventually becomes Amiri Baraka.
Yes,
and when you see Amiri, it's not just a great mind, a great spirit, but he comes out of a great family. And it's his father and mother that inspired him. His father and mother were part of Bethany Baptist Church. That's where branches of my family were, at Bethany Baptist Church. When I saw him standing over his father's coffin at Bethany, speaking about growing up in Newark, how his father worked with him and worked with the others in the community, how his father took him to the ball game, how his father helped develop him into his manhood, I was in tears of joy, because that's the experience I felt in the same Newark, New Jersey. But he was in another section of Newark, New Jersey. In that same high school, which was largely Italian-American, were two brothers, the Payne brothers, Donald Payne and Bill Payne, his elder brothers, in that same high school. So it wasn't just an individual thing. Here were two brothers who were doing it. One becomes a congressman, one becomes a state legislator. One, the oldest one, a bill sponsored the Amstead legislation to put the black history in the curriculum. But in that school were other brothers. There was the Sesame Peoples brother, Arnold and Sess Peoples. Arnold has passed on to ancestor realm. Sess was a great educator in Newark, not only a great basketball player, Arnold a great football player, but they also got involved in passing the legacy on. In that same high school were two brothers, the Jackson brothers. The elder Jackson was the star of the basketball team, and the younger Jackson, who was our pitcher on our baseball team. On the baseball team were other brothers, the Jeffries brothers. My younger brother, Marlon Jeffries, and his older brother, Leonard, me, I was the left fielder. My brother was the right fielder. Jimmy Drake was the center fielder. We had an all-star black outfield in a white high school in the Italian community. The brothers.
And you know, it's interesting, Dr. Jeffries, because that the more I hear from you and hear you speak, I'm so impressed. And one of the things that made me realize why I'm so impressed with you is because of your experience as a baseball player. I can go on for hours talking about my three tryouts for the Philadelphia Phillies. So they say great minds think alike. So obviously we're on the same way, not only with baseball, but Negro baseball. For those who just tuned in, we have on the line Dr. Leonard Jeffries, and as you can hear, he's a scholar, he's an activist, he's talking about how the family comes together, how the community comes together. We want to thank Leslie Gistov on the Gistov Freedom Blog Talk Radio for bringing us all together to talk about this. We have about 13 minutes left, but what I want to do at this point is talk about some potential solutions, Dr. Jeffries. You made
I'll say
it clear
that again.
That
I missed you. Oh, I missed you last thing.
What we want to do at this point is talk about some possible solutions in the 10 or 11 final minutes. You talked about how the family brought you and others to where you are. The community brought you and others. But at certain points, there were the drugs or whatever took place in the black community that set us back. What can we do today, 2011, 2012, to bring back that family consciousness and that community consciousness where we pull our pants up and open up a book? What can we do today?
Well, one of the things that we fundamentally have to realize is that black people are under attack. They have been for the last 500 years when we were taken out of Africa, and there has been all kinds of games played against black people by the various people who remain our oppressors. You have to have a systems analysis. If you don't have a systems analysis, you're looking at individual situations, individual circumstances, and you can't see the larger picture. I am what I am because of the system put in place by our community, working
mm-hmm.
around institutions, working around organizations, working around family connectedness, and seeing our people who weren't even our blood as family. We call them aunties and uncles. They weren't a part of our bloodline, but they were part of our community family. So we have to restore the family. Individual respect is necessary for self, but if you don't see self as an extended self, it's not going to go anywhere. Our unfortunate individualistic culture that hip-hop has, hip-hop didn't come out of that. Hip-hop came out of groups of brothers getting together, coming up with a little message, and coming
Amen.
Up with a formation
yes.
to tell people what to do. And then it was hijacked. It became gangster rap and all kinds of other things. And so that individualism, you out there holding on to your genitals, put your hands in the air, do what I do. And I said, well, who the hell is that that got thousands of people, white, black, Asians, Latino, putting their hands up in the air, and come to find out his name was Ludacris. Well, God, dog, Ludacris, that's the name. And he got people swaying back and forth and not about anything serious. We had a sense of mission and purpose and direction to do something. That has to happen in the home. But if the home is so busy, you're trying to work hard to get your little Cadillac and get this and that, the mother and fathers are there, and then the grandparents are not there to make up for the mother and fathers not being there, we got dispersed in this individualism of white folks integrating in their communities, moving away from your center and not going back and keeping that relationship. So the family connectedness fell apart. Individualism became our byword. I'm going to do my thing. I don't give a damn about it. My mother told me that my little brother was my responsibility. I knew early on when I was born in 1937, and here in 38, October, comes this other little beautiful youngster. I thought I was the center of the world, and then here comes this beautiful younger. I'm dark and, of course, good-looking. He is highly light. And good looking. So how was I going to compete with this little boy? So we were in the same bedroom. I knew I had to share space and place with him. But my mother said, no matter what you think you are as a superstar, the firstborn, your responsibility is to take care of him. And so that type of tradition that you got to share and take care of things, that's what we've lost. We bought on this white individualist thing. I'm going to do my thing. I ain't going to worry about no family. I ain't going to worry about no giving back. We were raised with the understanding that you sacrifice. You sacrifice to get somewhere. That's the first S. And that sacrifice to get somewhere, meaning you put in place ability to do something. And so that meant you had to serve, that you wasn't just serving yourself. You were serving your people. And that sacrifice to be somebody and that serving your people allowed you to think of success. My success is not an individual success. Yes, I've worked with some of the greatest people in the world. Dick Gregory is a friend of mine. I was with Alex Haley for 7 years. Yes, I went after Lafayette College to Europe to study in Europe, and not to study in English. I studied in French. Je parle très bien le français, presque comme le français. En effet, mes études de doctorat étaient faites en langue française. This poor boy from Newark, New Jersey, graduated from Lafayette College, went to Europe and kicked butt. And so it's not just a me, it's a we. We were trained as not just an ego, it's a we-go. And so that has been built into our understanding of things. We got to find formulas to get that back. Now, I'll be going to Senegal in a couple of weeks for the World Summit of Mayors. I was in Senegal in April. I was in Senegal in June. I was in Senegal in a year from April. Before April, I was with the leadership of Black America with Julian Bond and Jesse Jackson and all of the mayors, et cetera. So there is this connectedness going on among us to do something for Africa and to do something for our own community. So it's not a lost ball game. The larger system has been attacking us. We're losing jobs. We're losing our houses. We're losing our institution. But we still have the ability to rise. And the symbol of that rise is in Senegal. Senegal is the closest point to the Americas. Senegal has Gorée, the famous slave island, where many of our ancestors transited before they came to the Americas. But in Senegal now is not just the history of slavery, it is the projection of the future. There is a statue in Senegal put on a volcanic hill. That statue is the rise of the Black family. The centerpiece is the Black man rising, holding on to his rock in his right hand, his wife, and in his left hand, he's holding up his child. And the child is pointing not north to Europe, where we usually look for sustenance and guidance, not east to Asia, where the new boys on the block, India and China, are emerging, not east to Mecca, not south to Africa. That child is pointing west to the Western Hemisphere. It is the Africans in the Western Hemisphere, Canada, the United States, Central America, the islands of the Caribbean, Northern South America, Guyana and Suriname, and Brazil. It is that African awake and aware and linking to the African continent will be the future of our people. That statue was conceived of 7 years ago. It was built over a period of time. It was designed by the Senegalese, but it was built by the North Koreans because nobody builds monumentally like that again. That statue is taller than the Statue of Liberty in the harbor of these United States in the New York Harbor, which is a symbol of the struggle of the Black folk in the Civil War. The Statue of Liberty has not a damn thing to do with immigrants coming over from Europe. It was conceived by a Frenchman, Edouard René Lefleur de la Boulaye, who was the head of the French Anti-Slave Society in 1865. One of the greatest moments in history was when slavery was ended with Black folks, a half a million of them, participating in the Civil War, freeing themselves. And so then the Frenchman said, now we can honor America, now that slavery is ended. So the Statue of Liberty in the harbor is ours, but it's been hijacked. And so white folks think it's theirs and has nothing to do with us, but the chains at the foot of the Statue of Liberty reflect the chains of enslavement. But in spite of that American symbol, this African symbol is the new way, the rise of the Black family. It is taller than the Statue of Liberty. It is taller than Jesus, the Redeemer, that overlooks the bay in Rio de Janeiro. It is the tallest statue of its kind. You can go inside the base, and there's museums, there's exhibits, there's assembly rooms, there's meeting rooms, there's theater. You can take an elevator from inside the base and go up 15 stories through the thighs, the powerful thighs of the Black man, through his strong backbone and spinal column, through his broad shoulders, up through his neck, into his mind, into his head. You can look out the head. 25 to 30 people can be inside the head of the Black man looking out on the world. I've never conceived of anything that represented who and what we are and what we should be in my life. But it's there in Senegal. It's been built. I've been there several times. I'm going there in a couple of weeks. Someone has created a symbol. Why is a symbol important? Because whoever controls the symbols controls a good deal of the thinking. Whoever controls the knowledge controls the thinking. Whoever controls the images controls the self-esteem, what you think about yourself, the self-respect, who and what you think you are and how you respect others, and your self-development. We are in trouble since the late 70s and 80s and crack and other things. Miseducation began to dominate our world. We are in trouble because somebody else has controlled our images. So we have a low self-esteem. We have little respect for what is important. And we don't have self-development. We have arrested development. So we got to break that.
Yes, those of you just tuned in, you're hearing the words of the great Dr. Leonard Jeffries. The voice you hear right now is Attorney Michael Cord. I'm honored to be co-hosting on the Gist of Freedom, a show normally hosted by Leslie Gist. So on behalf of myself, Michael Cord, and Dr. Leonard Jeffries, I want to give a big shout-out to Leslie Gist and on the Gist of Freedom. We have about 3-4 minutes left, and we certainly want to wrap things up with Dr. Jeffries. One of the things I want to do, if folks want to contact me and Dr. Jeffries, who want to give his contact information, I'm with a group called ATAC, A-T-A-C, and I can be reach through the website www.avengingtheancestors.com, www.avengingtheancestors.com, or we can be emailed at attack@avengingtheancestors.com. That's ATAC at avengingtheancestors.com. We made history here in Philadelphia, ATAC did, by getting the first slavery memorial on federal property in American history. Never happened before. We got it here in Philadelphia on the grounds of Liberty Bell. In the last 2-3 minutes, we want to turn it over to Dr. Leonard Jeffries and tell folks, Dr. Jeffries, how they can get in touch with you. We hope to have you back on the show once again. But prior to that, if folks want to reach you, if there's email or Facebook or phone number, how can folks get in touch with you?
Well, certainly they can get in touch with us. Our big thing is to build institutions, build organizations, so we have several organizations. One of them is ASCAC, the Association for the Study of the Classical African Civilization. It has a mid-Atlantic region, which is based in Philadelphia. I think its next conference will possibly be this weekend coming up, or next weekend in Baltimore, I believe. I'm not sure exactly where it is.
It's
a whole
state in Maryland,
Okay, and is it this weekend or the following weekend?
It's this weekend, this Friday and Saturday.
Okay, I'm going to try to make sure I get down there. I got 15 other things to do, but I am now the succession president of ASCAC. I was the first vice president. Our president died. I am now the president, in essence, of ASCAC. We have another organization called the World African Diaspora Union, and that World African Diaspora Union is linked up with a brother called Dudley Thompson, who is our president. He was with Nkrumah and Jomo Kenyatta and others in the old days, and now he is a month from being 95. We are born on the same day. We're going to celebrate our birthdays in Newark, New Jersey together on the 21st of January, his 95th and my 75th. And the organization can be reached by 718-523-3312. Let me repeat it again, 718-523-3312. I can be reached on Facebook, Leonard Jeffries, Facebook page, handled by one of my young sons, adopted son, Brother Reggie. I can be reached at the City College, 212-650-8650. Let me repeat it, 212-650-8651. And
Dr.
I do
Jeffries,
have a home phone here, 201-837-1355. That's the home phone.
All right, that's great. In fact, I'm glad you gave all those numbers so folks can get in touch with you. If folks didn't write all that down, just call me and I'll put you in touch with Dr. Jeffries. I'm Attorney Michael Cord. That's 215-552-8751. 215-552-8751. Dr. Jeffries, we run out of time, but you have been
go
a
ahead,
great
brother.
Total.
And we got the tapes and we got other material that they can get so they can share some of this experience that I've been trying to express. So
thank you very much. Thank you very much. We want to thank Leslie Gist of the Gist of Freedom program, but most important, Dr. Leonard Jeffries.
All right, brother. Thank you now.
Thank you very much, and we'll be in touch. And thank you all for listening.